Good morning. It has been three and a half years since we were in this room and telling you guys about what we were planning to do and heading to Johannesburg, South Africa. So I want to catch you up, just really big picture. But before I do, my son Joseph is 17 now. When he was 11, just before we left, he was adopted. This was his neighborhood. At any rate, if you can imagine being a foster child, then being adopted, and moving to South Africa into a Zulu village, which I'm about to tell you about, some big changes. So, in particular, we're thankful to God that this neighborhood provided our son and the Lord's providence and all of that. It is good to be here. We moved to Johannesburg, and when we did, we were immediately looking for what ministry we were going to do. We knew that we were coming to work in a township-type setting. So township is where, you'll have to forgive me, the terms in South Africa are way different. They're very comfortable saying coloreds. Coloreds are a mix of someone who's Afrikaans or Indian and black. And they're very comfortable saying black. They're very comfortable using terms that we see as racially charged. So if I slip back into that, that's the ground we walk on, okay? So we are going to be doing ministry amongst the blacks in townships. And as we looked out, we found a church in Durban, South Africa, Grace Baptist Church of Manzantoti, which would be the head church, covering church, for a ministry called Seven Rivers Outreach. And it's amongst the Zulu people. There's 9 million Zulu-speaking folks in South Africa. If you expand that out, it comes to about 25 million who could understand Zulu when you put in the other similar languages. And we are right in that area there, about 20 minutes inland from the Indian Ocean. And we are in a Zulu village. The reason they call it Seven Rivers seems a little misleading. It's been 150 years since that farm was founded by Indians, and it came into the hands of missionaries about 12 years ago, our co-workers. But you cross the same river, not seven different rivers. So Three Rivers Grace is a little less misleading, right? So there are three rivers that meet. It's not seven rivers that meet. It's a one river, the Amahlangwa River, as they say, that you cross seven times to get to the farm. The critical thing about there being 9 million Zulu speakers and being in KwaZulu-Natal is that they really speak Zulu. Whereas you go to Joburg, they call it Joburg Zulu, which there's all these languages. So if you go to a church service in Joburg that's a black church, then they're probably going to be translating into several different languages. Where we are, there's no translation needed. Everybody's speaking Zulu. The Zulu are proud people. The way I want to approach this is that I'm going to tell you about the people, okay? And then you guys can ask me, and you're going to see how it relates to how you would do ministry there. They're a proud people. This is traditional dress for the ladies and for the men. And I want to walk through a Zulu worldview. This is actually a picture from very, very close. That's one of the crossings that we drive through every day. Yeah, walking through life, if you can read that, backwards. Walking through life backwards. This is the fundamental difference that I see amongst the Zulu and Westerners. If you were to open up a book on culture and read American culture and Zulu culture, we would be at opposite poles. I have asked myself oftentimes, what are they thinking? Okay, what's the last thing I would ever think of? Now, that's been the right thing several times, the right answer. Let me give you a very quick illustration of this. We're just baffled at times about what they're thinking. At the little church plant, Intabany Baptist Church, that we're planting a church there, they had speakers and a soundboard in the back, and the speaker was blown, and so some nice folks came through, and they had some old camp speakers, and they replaced them. They said, here you go, great, just plug it in. Speakers are blown, like the next week. So some months later, some nice folks come through and go, you guys need some speakers. And somebody said, yeah, please. And so they gave speakers and then they're blown immediately. You go, what's going on? So you find out now it's the third set of speakers are on their way and they're like, Time out, guys. Can we talk and figure this thing out? Why are we blowing the speakers? You know, we're trying to rig the soundboard so they can't turn it up. This is how different it is. The sound that they're looking for out of brand new speakers is the flap that you hear when the speakers are blown. That's their goal, is to get that sound. The reason is they want the powerful message to get out as far as it can, and they know that it's at maximum when they hear that sound. So put yourself in those shoes and think through that and figure out what to do. We don't have speakers right now because we're tired of blowing speakers. But walking through life backwards, everything begins at a funeral for the Zulu. Now, you say, we think everything begins at birth. And when I say the culture is different, I mean the culture is really different. Everything's starting at a funeral. So you prepare the ground for the next life. The African mindset, at least amongst the Zulu, I can't speak for other places, but I think it extends out into basically all tribal areas, sub-Saharan tribal areas. The mindset is that the living and the dead are walking beside each other. They're perceiving in this room, if I were just doing a traditional greeting, I'd say, we welcome the living and the dead. That's how I would greet you this morning. So at a funeral, they'll take the dead person through the room that they lived in. They may have been the worst kind of human being imaginable, but the second they die, they are worshipped, or they would say revered, but they'll sacrifice to them. At the end of their life, they're just beginning a long journey to get to God. So this long journey they're taking, let me explain it this way. My dad died in 2012, okay? So if I were Zulu and my dad died, my dad was an atheist. He wasn't really a great guy. He was a good provider. So there was some relief when he died because he was still married to my mother. So he wasn't a great guy. But the moment he died, I would go to a Sangoma, a witch doctor, and I would try to get in contact with him because I need him to be happy. And I need him to be happy because he's eventually going to get to God. And this is a God who's transcendent and not he's not omnipresent. He's not imminent. He's only far away. But my dead ancestor is going to get to God eventually. And when he does, he's going to tell God what God does not yet know, which is what kind of guy I am. And when he tells God what kind of guy I am, God can enter in and do good things or bad things to me. They just know this. In the same way we know, you know, children need to get a good education so that they can get a good job, so they can get a 401k, so that in their retirement years they can do what? Collect seashells, right? As Piper says, and don't waste your life. So but that's how the American mindset is. The average American just knows that's how you live. You make a plan and you achieve. They just know that you must make a plan to talk to the dead so that the dead can help you achieve. If they get to university, they'll say, we welcome the living and the dead. We thank the ancestors from where they've come. So they literally are walking through life looking backwards, whereas we walk through life looking forwards and projecting outwards on what's coming. They're looking back and they give credit to the dead for wherever they come. You guys are welcome to ask any questions. But the journey starts at the funeral. Goats and offerings are a way to appease the ancestors, make them happy with you. Yeah, kind of disgusting. These bracelets are goatskin bracelets. You can see easily who's been involved in some sort of ceremony. Oftentimes children who come to the church will have these bracelets because their parents or their mothers would have been doing the sacrifices and tying these around them, supposedly for safety. These are Sangomas in training, and we see people walking around in similar dress with makeup on and in this way. Sangomas will make you right with the dead. That's what they claim. And it's critical to see this because what's pouring out of the United States in the health, wealth, prosperity gospel is pouring into African TVs. And, you know, just the other day, we were sitting in the car and listening in one of the Christian radio stations, because we don't have a CD player because we're driving a missionary mobile. It's got only a tape player. So we're scanning the stations. And so at any rate, the song comes on and it says, you carried my pain, you carried my sickness on your shoulders. I think it was by King and Country. I have nothing against them. I don't really know them. But that was the lyrics on the song. And I just turned off for a second and said, guys, did you hear that? He's misinterpreting Isaiah, that by his stripes you're healed. That context, by his stripes we are healed, has nothing to do with physical healing. Has everything to do with having our sins forgiven. That is completely consistent with the health, wealth, prosperity gospel that's pumping into the TV stations there. So here's why it matters. Christian pastors to the Zulu are essentially some sort of Sangoma-style person. Meaning, the Sangoma says, I will talk to your dead relative and make them happy for you. The Christian pastor to them will talk to God. And the ultimate goal is to get to God through the dead relative. We'll talk to God because he has powerful prayers. They pay the Sangoma to intercede with the dead. They pay the Christian pastor, and I should say rather the false pastor, right? They pay him to get to that. So people ask me to pray for them consistently. I have to make sure that when I do that, that I'm not standing in the stead of Sangoma. So I would say to them, you know what? God has adopted me, and so I'm happy to pray to you because my father listens just because he's adopted me, because his son died for me. And any Christian who talks to the Lord, he listens. The Lord's right here. And then when I pray, I'm hammering omniscience, omnipresence. Lord, we thank you that you know everything. We thank you that you're here in this room, that you listen to us, that you care, that we can get to you. We don't have to wait for our ancestor to talk to you. We're praying that all the time. And people are asking me to pray for them a lot because they think somehow I have special access to God that they could never have. And so we have to be careful in how we speak. But this is what they're trying to get at. They're saying, well, maybe the Sangoma's not everything, so we'll talk to the Christian pastor too. But they assume that I'm what they see on TBN and a couple other stations. It's actually really sad. You go into this rural village. It's only had electricity for about 10 years, and they have TV on, and it's always on, and what's it on? One of three Christian stations with a pagan naming the name of Christ and spewing out a false gospel.
It's
a good question. A lot of them do understand English. We are working on learning the Zulu language, and our area director is reminding us of that constantly. Learn the language. So that when we moved there, there's like 12 different languages in South Africa. We didn't know which language we were going to need to learn. So when we realized it was going to be Zulu, we started learning. So we are. And so we say, Kanani, Kanani, which is little by little. It's coming. Difficulty, it's not French or Spanish or something like that, so you're not going to get Berlitz, you know, some sort of online program. We hire tutors, but then we actually need to train them in the Zulu language. I mean, they speak it, but to be able to identify what a verb and a noun is and how they function, we actually need to train them. So it's a bit difficult. And someone would ask this. We're living on a farm. It's about a 100-acre farm. And we'll get into why we're doing that in shortly. But power and water are things that we have to struggle with turning off. So you can imagine if you have people who speak English in your area, imagine a Spanish immigrant in a place where lots of people speak Spanish. They're going to take a bit longer to learn English, right? So. It is. I tremble to say this because I'll then be held accountable for it, but I need to be. It's critical that we learn the language, and we are learning it. We are learning it, but you guys should hold us accountable. I'm saying it. We must learn the language. There are so many people who speak English, but there's a lot that don't. So they believe in something called limited good. So that's rotten corn on that side and a healthy corn plant on the other. So let's just say that Pastor Ben is a really good farmer, okay? And so he tills the land. Everything's perfect. He has the right amount of nitrogen in the soil, and he plants the corn, and it's beautiful. I, however, do a really bad job. I just buy an old bag of corn and throw it out there, and it really doesn't grow up well. Okay. As an African, as a Zulu, this is what I'm thinking. You stole my power. There's only limited good in this world. And I know that you've either been to Sangoma and you got some booty, some medicine, and so you have paid for this power. Or somehow God's just favoring you more. In either case, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm going to go burn your corn crop down. The reason I'm going to burn your corn crop down is to release the power so that my corn will do better. It's not because I wasn't as hard of a worker or didn't have insider knowledge. It was power was stolen. Again, it's polar opposite of what we think. We don't think that way. But that's what they're thinking. That's really something when you see what's happening, you're sitting back and going, why would they do that? It's fear. They are fearful that God is doing something that's not good for them. And so then they're taking action. Yes. That's exactly right. So if we want to help someone start a business, like one of our coworkers did years back, and so they set up a stand and they're selling things, well, what happens to the stand? Literally, they burned it down. This is over in Johannesburg. Why did they burn it down? Was it jealousy? When we think, well, there must be some personal relationship, animosity or something. It was belief system. They genuinely think, I'm doing poorly because he's doing well. And so they want to free that power up. This little girl lives in our village. And that face is amazing. That's her face. That's how she looks. All right, authority gap. Authority is absolute. There's a high authority gap. So I'm teaching this morning. If I told you guys to stand on the table and all jump off, of course you would, right? Just because, even if you know the tables are going to flip over or whatever, you're probably going to stand up and jump on it. Authority is very high, and when you follow, you are underneath. So this hurts them in this way. You don't actually have to prepare to assume a leadership position. You're given the leadership position, and you just are in charge, and everybody will do what you say. That authority gap explains a great deal. Jacob Zuma, the president of South Africa, before he was elected, and I'd have to read to get really accurate on this, but this is the word on the street that I've heard from a couple sources. He went on trial for assault, sexual assault. In fact, he had impregnated his niece. And when he took the stand at his defense, he didn't give a defense at all. He basically said she should be very happy that he received the seed of a very powerful man. And then he was elected president. Once again, this isn't Bill Clinton. This is Bill Clinton times 10, right? This is actually somebody standing up and very proudly glorying in their shame. But why would he do that? How do you know that wasn't going to be political suicide? It's the authority gap. And it's limited power. He's a powerful man in a strong position. So he's reminding his people of what matters. Is I'm strong and powerful. What I've done isn't so important. Who I am and the position I hold is everything. So then it's no wonder that he's not at all prepared for his position. He just assumed power, and that means everything. So you don't need to train to be in leadership. You just need the position. Position is everything. That hurts them. That hurts them greatly. And that also helps us understand when we're trying to train leaders for the church, why they're not motivated. Why they just sit back and they just wait for the title. Get the title, they're good. It explains why there's a young lady that's working in our house. When she got a coat, a maid's coat, she was super happy. She now had a position. She had some status that told them who she was. Anything to add on that? Okay, out in the villages, where are the men? They've all gone to try to find jobs in the city. And so then they come back and they bring with them HIV and bring with them just all the difficulties of having essentially abandoned their families. Communication's not good. So they may or they may not come back. The men just aren't there. So guys like this are the future of our church. We got two young men. I'll tell you a little bit about them in a few minutes. And they are in their early 20s. That's the future of the church. Older men, they do not go to church. It's just that's for women and children, so they won't go. Where are the jobs? What are people going to do? Out in the village, you can get a job working on an Indian farm there. You're going to make somewhere around $7 a day for a 12-hour job. It's ladies in the field working, and many more would take those jobs if they would just offer them. But there's not enough jobs. People are willing to work for pennies.
Zulu don't work for Zulu.
No.
Again, the whole power thing, limited power. But Zulu will work for white or Indian. Indian as in like from India, type Indian. But they've been in South Africa for centuries. Zulu don't work for Zulu. Indians and whites are the people that provide the jobs, and the Zulu work for them. And that's okay. But for a Zulu to work for another Zulu, we need almost a Zulu.
Yeah, almost suicide because the authority gap. Because there's a lot of problems. In our area, we would estimate there really aren't any formal marriages as we would know them at all. So now you're looking at planting a church. How are you going to plant a church without married couples? I mean, we take marriage a little bit for granted here. I mean, I understand the numbers are falling and people are living together before marriage, but nothing like South Africa. There just aren't married couples in our village. When she says maybe a few, and that really describes the problem. We're not quite sure. They call it that, and they have some ceremonies, but we're still working through exactly what that is, because really every ceremony we encounter is so bizarre to us and so different from what we've seen. We're just being very slow in listening and asking lots of questions. You'll see the cows here. The Zulu are an agrarian people. And so if you want to get married, it's going to take you 11 cows. That's the bride price. They call it lobola. And lobola, you can imagine, try to get a job. There aren't jobs. But if you do stay, it's going to take 11 cows. Cows about $800. You know, maybe you get a little bit better price. Maybe you can have a family member who raises cows, and so you can have some calves. This is why at the last coming out party that we were at, the two ladies who were coming out were in their 40s and they all had kids. They all have kids by teenage years. But so talking to a young man about baby ministry, because he's looking like a faithful young man, now how's he going to get married? Because he wants to get married. But nobody's married around him, so he doesn't have the example. We're the example. But we don't exactly fit anything they know. We do all kinds of strange things that they don't understand. So, making $7-$8 a day to try to get $10,000 so that they can get married, and that's all negotiated by the families. Even if the mom or the dad says, we'll waive the lobola, we understand, you want to stay pure, we're Christians. Grandma and the aunts and uncles are all going to demand it. No, we don't. We formally remove you for that. It's a major problem. So how do we have hope of churches without men? I mean, the old view still is, there's truth in it. You know, we, 10 families where the men are paying 10% will provide for a pastor to study the word and teach. I mean, that's just the mathematics of it. Say 20 would provide for a missionary to go to the next village and to do that same job. Two churches can get together, and you know, if you have 5 men from one church and 5 men from another who are paying 10% of their salary, then you can send another missionary, right? So it ought to be that 20 families, you got to have a pastor, and you could give well to get the gospel to the next village. But if you have no families, where's that coming from? The mom's working; she can't provide for her kids. The dad's, who knows where? You can see the despair that we're dealing with and the situation. And you can see why we're saying, if the Lord allows, we plan to live there and die there. I mean, we see ourselves as seeds for the gospel, because this generation is not at the place where they can, that they're going to be able to change this. Which is why the gospel's been there for so many years. And really, when you go around, there are not any churches like this. None in the Zulu-speaking people. There are some Health, Wealth, Prosperity. There are some charismatic churches that we think may have the gospel right. There's a Sovereign Grace Church, but they're speaking in English. And then it's sort of in the Zulu area. There's a few little things, but like this, there's nothing that would be like a Three Rivers Grace amongst the Zulu people. Nothing. And it starts with the marriage.
There are a lot of churches that use scripture
Right. They just have the wrong Jesus. Jesus is there to provide them stuff. They just have the wrong Jesus. The infection rate is 50%. This was at one of the coming out ceremonies where we took this picture. And so these are children we know. But it's true. We have workers in our home with HIV. We have workers around. I mean, you could just say, really, it's going to sound dumb. Half the people have HIV. It's 50%. Absolutely. Through U.S. dollars. So the UN and the U.S., you know, it's been in the news lately that we're like 30% of the UN budget or something like that. Well, we have provided all the ARVs, antiretroviral drugs, okay, ARVs, to South Africa. So if you have HIV, then you have free medication. Here's the difficulty. You still have to take it 24 hours apart essentially to the minute. You need to be, so if you choose 8 a.m., take it 8 a.m. every morning, that or the virus mutates. Then put yourself as somebody out in a rural village. Where's your local health provider? How are you going to get to them? So in our circumstance, that's about 7 kilometers, 3.5 mile walk, and I mean, it's over a mountain. So then you're going to be walking there. By the time you find out that you have HIV, you're probably suffering from tuberculosis or something. So you take that to the ground. It's true. If someone gets there and they get tested and they find out that they have it before they get ill, before they get full-blown AIDS, they can go, and if they can get to the clinic every month and so they don't run out, then they can live a full life. But just imagine how many people can pull that off out where we are. That's the problem. Gogo Kayula is a lady. I wish I had I should add her picture in. She's passing away, but earlier this year, we got to share the gospel at her son's funeral. I think she's in her 70s. It's hard to tell because, you know, rough life, give or take 10 years, you know, she's probably somewhere around 70. But preached the gospel at her son's funeral. She'd gotten HIV by taking care of her daughter, as her daughter was dying of HIV some years back. And she's in our church. I think she's a believer. She continues to pray for her grandchildren. One of her grandsons has HIV. Right before we came, I was able to take him to the clinic to pick up his next prescription. But he had been off of it for some time, which for someone with HIV, that's really not good. I mean, that's a bad thing. Multiply that across the village. I'm not there to take people for those meds. I'm there to preach the gospel and to get it as far as I can. But these are our neighbors, right? So, of course you're going to take them, right? The most you can. But it's overwhelming. Gogo Kayula is concerned who's going to take care of her kids. There's about 700 to 800 kids per social worker. In the first world, in Johannesburg, Durban, and Cape Town, and a number of other cities, that's a whole lot like the way we live here. Less options on the grocery store shelves, but the grocery stores are full. You know, you can live, you can go to Dunkin' Donuts or McDonald's or many of the conveniences we have here. But you get out in the village, and it's just not that way. Yes. What's it called? It was a new word. Umumula.
And where traditionally it was 20 or 21, where the girl is presented to the community saying she's now of a marriageable age, and people give gifts of money for her to help start setting up her hospital. They actually call her a bride, even though there's no room. And they give her money so that she starts to set up her hospital, and she's now available. So in our case, I mean, the women are in their 40s,
So, and when you're thinking about that, you say living with their family. Let's just talk about the village life for a moment. There's about 20 orphan-led homes in our village, in the conglomeration of villages around where we are, and which means, you know, you got a 13-year-old, a 12-year-old, whatever the age is, caring. Say family, there really aren't dads. I mean, go find a home with a dad in it. They're just not there. They're in the towns. A child will maybe have 6, 8, 10 grandmothers, because the grandmothers, whatever home an old lady lives in, where they happen to be sleeping, would be home. And the school system set up. We're going to talk about the school system in just a moment, but that's you go for a year into a different home, you have a different grandmother. That's why one family, there's a story, and I don't know how, the truth of this, but it fits, that the guy comes and says, I need time off to go to my grandmother's funeral. So they give him time off, and he does it again a few weeks later. And then the third time, within about 3 months, he needs to go to his grandmother's funeral, he gets fired, because that's really the worst streak of bad luck if you had your step-grandmother, your real grandmother, and another, you know, your grandmother on the paternal side all die in a three-month period. You're just trying to get time off. But actually, the truth is they may have 8 grandmothers, according to the way they call it. Their family structure is not the same as ours. On the dad's side, you have an older dad, which is your uncle. You have your dad and then a younger dad. And the older dad can trump what your dad says. On the mother's side, you don't call it an uncle. They call it a mama's daddy. Your mama's brother is your dad on your mom's side. So families, I mean, just you lay that out and look at that family structure for a while. Well, it's not God's design. And that's the way they're thinking. So, you know, we say family, but it's not what we're imagining. Yes. Yes, Tom. There's no children here. A Zulu man or an African man can demand sex from any woman he sees at any time. As long as she's not married, thank you. That's their mindset amongst the pagans. I mean, some would probably take umbrage with that, but a Zulu man can just demand sex at any time from an unmarried woman. So Aaron's protection from that is that she's got a wedding ring on and they know me as her husband. But you want to, you know, when, and if the father's there, a daughter's protected according to the father. So, for instance, we had a young lady who lived with us for a year. We had a long conversation and said, I'm your dad. You know, treat me like your dad, and I'm going to protect you. Just trust me, please, in terms of going out and when you go out and where you go out. Well, for the time you're here, you know.
And that's just because of the young lady living in our home, even though you're not her father, it still fits. You can call her your daughter and protect her because she's in your house.
So we had a young lady from the Pittsburgh area who came out and stayed with us for 6 months. And, you know, we did have to have that conversation. And it's a big adjustment. It's a 23-year-old lady who was managing a bakery. And so for her to then listen to me saying, no, you can't go on a walk. Sorry, you know, and talking through why she can't just go for a walk and under what conditions can she go for a walk, when and with who, that kind of thing. And it's not because why would I want to limit somebody? It's just, I want to send you back home safe and sound. Yes.
So it sounds to me like they do honor that a woman's married, they don't respect her.
Yeah.
What happens if they're
still? I think it's just, I don't know what happens. I mean, the area we live in has so many court cases. Security, that just moves to security a little bit, isn't who you know. So the best thing we can do to protect my family is to get to know the grandmothers and the aunties and the uncles. So if some guy gets some idea to do something, he knows that it's going to disappoint his grandmother. That is the security. Well, no, that matters. That's real security, because the grandma's going to die and get to God and tell on him. See, we're thinking from an American standpoint, well, who cares if they know your grandmother? Right? But that's an American, that's our thought.
We go from 17 to 11.
I shudder. Yeah, that. Thanks for that. Yeah, legal consenting age. Okay. I don't know if we're... Okay, 5 million orphans in South Africa, orphans and vulnerable children. Orphan-led homes, there's about 20 in our area. That's one of the homes we visited many times. What of education? That's a little girl with some young ladies in school uniforms. 37% is passing. So in mathematics, 37% is passing. That's a shocking figure. You can imagine that we're not having a lot of doctors and qualified people coming out of the school system. For all of South Africa. That doesn't mean that individual schools don't have higher standards. That's the government standards. So
there are many individual schools, not our area, but in the city, that have much higher standards. If they look at it, obviously ridiculous. But the government national standard is very tough. And you do not have to actually have 37% in all of your subjects to graduate.
Right.
You only have to have 37% in a majority of them. You can actually fail some and still get a certificate of graduation.
I guess it goes without saying, but you know, you process this for a while. If you know 37% is passing in mathematics, I wasn't great in math. I came from a family of engineers, okay? But I wasn't particularly great in math. If I knew 37% would do it, I mean, how can you do even basic algebra? You're never going to get there because it only gets more and more complicated. They tie children to their back, which sounds Latino. I mean, my wife grew up in Guatemala. That's what they would do. But in here, it's a little bit different. Tell the children to be quiet. They don't put them down to play, so the kids don't stack blocks. They are told of limited power. They're told of the ancestors. Their motivation to get educated is pretty low, and you might say that they struggle with sequencing, or you know, just saying okay, first, second, third. I mean, genuinely, we had a guy who came in and did plaster on our walls at an addition that we had in our 1,100 square foot home with my office and our bedroom plus one for the five boys and the loft for my daughter. So we're working on that. But this guy's coming in plastering, and he didn't know how to calculate square meters. So he came for me to pay him on day one, and we pay by the day. And so he says, okay, length plus width. And I just looked at my wife and said, this is going to be cheap, right? It's going to be the cheapest job we ever paid for. This guy's been doing it for 25 years. He's from our village. He was in town for a holiday, and he was going to do our job then. And so when I told him, I think it's length times width, you know, to get area, he looked at me cross-eyed until he saw that the number was bigger for length times width, which I pointed out to him. If I were trying to deceive you, I would give you the smaller number. It's length times width. So we pay him properly. Okay, so what shall we do? We are planting churches. That's the idea. How would you plant churches in a place like this? I mean, we're not special. We don't have access to another scripture. We don't have a special amount a special extra amount of grace for this. Right? What would you do? How would you plan this? And fasting? Yeah? Okay. What else? A lot of money never hurts. Yeah. That wouldn't be my first response, but yes, it's true. What'd you say?
Evangelism.
Yeah, evangelism. Okay, that's right. So The answer is you plan it like you do every other church. You take time, take as much time as you need to disciple, to follow the gospel out. Someone's converted and you disciple them. In our case, it's just that we have a Judeo-Christian worldview. You know, someone has asked, look, are they, it comes to my mind, is there a lack of intelligence? Which is a politically incorrect question to ask. But I'm telling you, when you work there and you're seeing things happen, it actually sort of matters to know what you're actually dealing with. So, I mean, you wouldn't want to think that that's a possible answer, but you'd better know if it is, because you're dealing with it. And my answer is unequivocally, absolutely not. It is not a lack of intelligence at all. It's no genetic thing that's holding them back, as far as I can tell. It's the worldview. It's 100% worldview. If you have your worldview upside down and nothing is systematic and nothing works upon the precepts of God's word, then you're going to end up with a totem pole or end up with something that you're going to worship. Okay. Aaron's going to tell you about a beef project. This is one of the solutions for how we're working to plant churches.
How fast do I need to go?
You've got...
Sorry, I'll let you like 7 minutes.
Okay, I'm going to go fast. Jobs, which means the adults, it's not just the men that are leaving for the cities, it's the women too. There have been numerous women that have left their kids with the grandmothers or the aunties, and they leave to go into work. They come back to either drop off new kids or because they ran out of work and have nothing to do then, or to come home to die. So when the adults leave, there's a whole bunch of older people or lazy people and a whole bunch of children left in the villages generally. When you have no families, you really have no church.
That outfit was from the Umagulu, the coming out ceremony. Aaron just happened to snag that picture, so that really is local dress.
Yeah. Coming home for a special ceremony, then go back to work.
Yes.
We have to come up with a solution for an income in the rural setting so that we have families that exist in the rural setting so that we can get the gospel out. We need a solution that is not income attached to U.S. charity dollars, because that's not sustainable. And so we're trying to develop the groundwork for a ministry that's independent, self-sustaining, and reproducible. We looked around then in January and started saying, okay, what are our available resources? Well, there's a proficient amount of QDs, and the picture there is a witch doctor, and she's wearing strands and strands of these beads that come out of the river. And then we also have a whole bunch of glass beads all over the place, because the Zulu use glass beads in their traditional dress. Next, go ahead.
No, at least thinking that these beads have some sort of power.
Right? No.
So that's been a question that's been asked a lot. So they're just that they're plentiful. It's not that they're associated particularly with ancestors.
If you wear them like that, then it's you're a witch doctor. But if you wear one strand or two strands, you're fine. Then it's just a decoration. The Wabasi plant grows wild all along the river, and of course the river goes through our valley all over the place. We just did an estimation of how many beads we could grow on our farm, and we estimate it's about 116,000 a year is what we're harvesting at the moment. When the beads are ripe, we pick them, we allow them to dry on trays in the sun, and after about 3 weeks in the sun, the beads reach their final color. Then what we're doing, and right now this is an income generating project for some women. We desire, and we're going to also create projects for the men, because we have to have men. It's just that this was simple, easy, and immediate, and so it was in our hands. So we took that and ran with it. The ones for the men require some more background research and training we don't all have. It's in the process, but it's not there yet. So with the beads in particular, the river beads, they're picked and dried on the farm. Then I have some girls that come in. My girls combine the river beads with the glass beads in whatever patterns I give them. And then each necklace, it has to be inspected. That's the missionary's job at the moment. Tied and finished, we're inspecting for accuracy to make sure the patterns are right. These are my girls. Yes.
Are you taking the same risk as that guy with the pink suit? You may wake up.
No, I'm white.
Right.
White people have power. They think, I mean, it's ridiculous. But they assume, oh, because you're white, well, then somehow naturally you have more power. That's okay. I'm not blue. I could also be Indian, that would be all right as well. I'm not blue. It's different.
What about for the students that are working for you?
Then it's okay because they can see the direct connection. Those who are working for me, therefore, it's me giving them, it's okay.
But you're right. If they were getting 10, 20 times the salary, and they go and get a car and drive it,
then
those are both good observations.
As long as, yes, go ahead.
What about your son? He's pretty much of age. Does he consider it a Zulu?
He's one of us.
So he's the
one
of white.
Yeah. The other missionary couple on the farm has four adopted Zulu daughters. They're also okay. They're adopted by the white. They're white. I mean, they're not Zulu, but it's just a different mindset.
And we're not in danger of upsetting your ancestors. They're not Zulu. Their ancestors are going to care about Zulu stuff. So it's not so much racial denial as it is cultural. They just don't see us as part of their ancestors.
We have
about 3 minutes left.
Okay.
So I don't
mean, yeah, no problem.
Sorry.
These are my girl. Ntoko is 23. She is one little girl who lives at the little girl's father's home. She's an orphan. Her parents died when she was 9 or 10. She does not have a high school degree. Chance of employment is very limited. Ayanda is 17. She dropped out of 11th grade last year because she was pregnant. Oyuche is a little baby. He's now, I guess, 7 months old. I need to update the slide. And on Father's Day, we had a sermon in our church, and after listening to that sermon, she said, look, I'm ready to stop this. I'm ready to get serious. So we're looking to see growth there and are encouraged at the moment. Makuti is 19. She has a one-year-old baby girl. She lives with her mother and 7 other minors in the home. She is the only one with any sort of income coming into that home. Again, no high school degree. Nana is 23. She's about to have her first baby. She has tried to pass, I believe it is 10th grade now, 3 years in a row, and she dropped out last year. So those are my four girls that actually make the necklaces for me. Just quickly run through. The idea started in January. In June, or actually in May, I took over the project, and I worked to put together basically a business plan. In June, I brought on 2 more girls, because originally there were only 2, so I doubled my workers. And I started paying the girls by the completed necklace, which initially made their salary go down, but what they were getting. So they're very pleased with that. Their production has tripled. And they've just signed contracts so that they're not employees of ours, they're like franchisees. They're in control of their work. We merely open the door and say, if you want the opportunity to make money, you can come in, and they do. And then we pay them by the completed necklace at the end of every day, so they can then walk out with that money and take care of their families. I know Makuti, whenever I ask her, you know, what are you saving your money for? She's like, diapers and food. That's just her consistent answer. So I'm hoping that by the end of next month, I will have a better idea of how to market this in the U.S. and South Africa. I'm working on that. But again, the goal is church planting. A portion of the profit is going to the girls. They're getting paid every day. A portion of the profit is going to the farm operating costs, and that includes the Bible studies, the rental of the vehicles, the pickup, you know, renting, Yeah, everything. And then part of it is going directly to the church to help fund the church and everything that entails.
Yeah, so the beach shop is bringing in half of our
That's
budget.
The next slide.
Yeah, okay.
Currently, with our very limited farm budget, because we're not operating, I mean, we just got approved in January, but currently the beach shop provides about half of everything the farm needs to operate.
The farm started